The following is a Serious Sports presentation.
Right now, it's time to dig out the jams, motherfucker! Kick out the jam. Yes, kick out the jam.
Welcome in to another edition of the Walk-Ons Podcast. Chip Patterson and Hayes Permar. He's Chip Patterson. I'm Hayes Permar. Sitting in here with you for some college basketball talk. Chip, I should start by wishing you a happy birthday. So let's do
Thank
that.
You so much. I appreciate that.
And then I'm going to start next. I'm going to follow that by patting ourselves on the back, because I believe there is no denying that our last podcast exacted change within the NCAA. I don't have the clip ready, but we definitely talked about how there needed to be some change, some transfer reform. And I can't remember if we took sides exactly where we wanted to see it. I think we just both said there needs to be more consistency. This whole being able to apply for a hardship stuff is tough, because and the graduation the graduate school rule basically forces kids to lie to fit through the loophole. So now, and I don't think they've addressed the graduate school issue one, but they have addressed the sort of special exemption. If you are transferring, you know, to be closer to a sick parent or sick grandparent or whatever that might be, the NCAA is saying, absolutely, we'll always allow you to transfer, but across the board, there's not going to be any of this play right away, even if your dad is legitimately sick and we can all see him in the hospital dying. What we're going to do is, if you're transferring for that reason, then we think
you add it on the end.
You want to spend time with him, so we're going to give you that year off, but we will not penalize you with eligibility. We'll say, move back, go get reassociated, take some time at your new school where you're not playing. We won't keep the clock running on your eligibility, and we'll be able to tack it on at the end. So if you really just wanted to move and have 3 years to play, you'll move and have 3 years to play.
Right, and I think that in the last podcast, you and I have the same idea. It was like, we don't know what the right answer is. We just know that what's going on is not going to be able to continue without having some more conflict. So at least at this point, because there was nothing worse than a player decides he's going to transfer, cites an ailing mother, and then, like, no joke, opposing message board is like, that's BS.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you don't want to have the lunatic fringe, as your boy DG likes to call him. You don't want to have those, like, crazy fans harassing a family that might actually be dealing with a sickness just because they're trying to figure out whether or not this is legit.
And who can say what, sickness affects different people different ways. Your mom may fall ill with something that I say, that you say, that's okay. I'll see her and I'll call her more. And my mom may get the same thing. And I say, well, I want to be by her side.
We don't know what the relationship is, or the NCAA
sitting as judge and jury as to what a family dynamic needs to be. So in that sense, and because they probably don't get it enough, I think we should give the NCAA credit for at least making it more consistent. Now, some people would say kids should be able to jump school to school, whatever. I don't think we've solved the problem, because it still looks bad PR-wise when a kid who hasn't started at a school but has signed a letter wants to transfer and they won't let him out, or they want to make restrictions as to where he goes. We still have some distance to go with that.
Right.
And it still is sort of a black eye. And not that the school or the coach that does those things doesn't have some reasoning. I can definitely sympathize with folks. But it's never going to look good, and it's never going to – it's going to be a hard one for schools and coaches to win of this kid should have to honor the letter he signed at age 18 and has to play for me now, even though he grew 4 inches and can play somewhere else now.
Well, especially in this, in addition to the transfer culture is the talking about transfer culture, which we might have cashed in on. I mean, we might have done that on our last podcast, but I don't think that you or I take the spotlight approach. And there are people that campaign right now looking for every transfer that's being held against his or her will, to the point where I'm getting women's basketball transfer issues are rising to like the top because that is a topic of high debate and one that is very controversial. It's similar to any issue comes up and, you know, PR guys, lawyers, or whoever it might benefit is now all of a sudden looking for, you know, every player that might be caught in that situation just because it's part of the national conversation.
It's interesting. You know, you would
– like how much of this it would go on and previously we would have never had an idea, and how much of it is, yeah, like, you know, and coming from someone who is a national writer and, like, covers college athletics, you see somebody, especially on a short form sharing like Twitter, it's like, horrible story with this women's college basketball player that's being kept in prison.
I'm right.
Come on, how much research have you author
done,
you know, done
exactly
on this situation?
What, yeah. No, it like I said, it still looks bad when they're holding a guy's eligibility sort of hostage.
Right.
But I'd be curious. I assume coaches, if they you know, were put in a room and nobody could know who said what, and they had to vote as to whether or not they would get rid of transfers altogether. I don't know. I mean, don't you think there's some part where coaches kind of like it? Because, A, if you got a headache on your team, like, fine. I mean, don't you kind of want to let them transfer? I mean, I know there's some pride and you put some time into recruiting the guy, but who wants to keep a guy that doesn't want to be there? And then
I've got nothing against players transferring, by the way.
Well, but then there is the complication of, do you want to then, as a – if you know every year almost everybody's a free agent, do you as a coach want to have to recruit transfers? How do you draw up what's legal or whatever, ethical in that sense? You know, is it and as always, I don't know all the issues. I'm not a college coach, but it's just when you put a relationship in terms of, you know, when a guy can or can't talk to it. And you want them to foster a relationship with them as high school players, but then say, well, now don't talk to him, even if you became friends with him and he wants some advice as he's, you know, having a tough time at his regular school.
Tampering issue, which was obviously big with Devontae Graham, the guard, former Broughton guard, who had to go to the Brewster Academy because Appalachian State wouldn't let him out, and they accused a couple schools of tampering, and now that's kind of rearing its ugly head again.
So we'll see how that one solves. But kudos to the NCAA for listening to
absolutely,
us and making
the
exemption.
For listening to the walk-ons. You know, that was big.
Hey, maybe we'll have something here, a suggestion that could help you out as well. Never know. Every now and then we strike gold. But
all right, here, great suggestion.
Okay.
If you only have two people sitting at the sushi bar at Kanki or any of your favorite Japanese restaurant, can be solid because you don't have the gamble of who else is going to be sitting at your 10-person table. You miss out on getting shrimp tossed into your mouth, but you do get to watch some sushi preparation, and if the sushi chef is nice, they might kick you one.
That's fantastic. You changed gears faster than I was expecting there, but it absolutely fits in this new era of all you can eat. I mean, the NCAA is going to have to be able to determine, like, what does that mean, sushi bar or the hibachi grill? Which one can you? But so you're saying in a normal setting where most people go to the hibachi grill, partly for the entertainment of sitting around, I have never actually opted out of that and sat somewhere else. You're saying with two people only, it's an okay move.
It's an okay move. You miss out on the presentation, but you get your food fast. And when I'm there, I mean, I understand some people are going for the experience.
Sure.
I'm just going for the Emperor's Delight, and they'll bring everything out. Got a little bit of sushi too. It was it was a strong move, and you know, I've had that one in my back pocket for 3 hours, so if you're going to ask for a good suggestion, I might as well get it out early.
It's a bit of a wild card, you're right, because you don't know when you're going to get stuck with a loud birthday party or an it's a wild card when you sit down.
I've been beside a breakup before.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Awesome. I mean, it was so...
Listen, that's what I mean. Yeah. Sometimes it looks like it could be bad, but then it ends up being good.
It was like guy and girl, and... Guy thought very highly of his job, girl did not, and that just fueled the entire, like, breakup. Like, what do you tell people I do? Nobody asks what you do. Like, and they just started sparring, and I'm there with my parents and a few friends, and by the time they are cleaning the, like, they've already delivered all the food. By the time they're scraping the grill, we're all silent, just tuned in.
That's fantastic.
Front row seat.
Now, I often go, like, I'll go with one niece or another. So I've been sometimes where I'll be attached to a fairly large party, taking up most of the table. I've definitely been at a birthday party where we spent the entire meal trying to determine the relationship of the people involved. Like, it was just an odd mix of people. Two guys that could have been the father, and or it could have been one that's a stepfather, but you couldn't figure out exactly what the relationship. Then some older people, and you're not sure if you know whose parents they're of, and there wasn't any terrible drama, but when there was a discipline or a don't do this or this, you're trying to figure out who's with who. It was an odd, and I think there was some multiple marriages involved trying to work the birthday together, which probably is tougher than
I know. That's one of the reasons I love the hibachi grill. I mean, it is just a unbelievable melting pot of personalities and people.
Well, we did talk about this sort of in jest. Do you think that a lot of people don't appreciate, like, the classic when we talk about NCAA eating, cream cheese will be in, like, the Hall of Fame, is the Condiment Hall of Fame, simply because of NCAA rules. Yeah. But somewhere that, you know, there's a reason that rule came about. And we've talked about this sometimes on the show where, and this is different from feeding players, but let's just look at recruits, for example, and how you get to rules where they are. Well, let's say a guy goes to visit and people find out, well, some school is going above and beyond with what they do them. So they say, hey, NCAA, we need to put limits on what a school can do for a kid, right? They say, okay, that's fine. But, you know, we should all agree they should be able to eat dinner when they come and they stay the night. Like, yeah, okay, NCAA says, cool, you can have dinner. So school A says, great. And they serve them the nicest thing they have at their nice dining hall. And it's a nice steak, you know, and then whatever. It's a good dinner. The kid's impressed. Then he goes to school B and they're like, all right, we're going to serve you dinner. And they take you in a helicopter and they, you know, jet you across to like a famous person's house. And they have like good looking women and they serve you meals on meals forever. And they give you doggy bags, take, you know, and it's ridiculously exorbitant of what a meal should be. So then somebody has to step in and say, okay, you can serve them dinner, but it can't be any more than $40. And
right.
Somebody says, well, what about this? What about that? And that's where you get into the nitpicking. And I think the pendulum is now swinging back. We're opening it up. My question is, with the all-you-can-eat policy, are we going to see people trying to exploit? We've already seen, you know, Oregon as a famous one, some training tables that are clearly made to look, you know, bigger and grander than ever. Now, are we going to actually have hibachi grills and sushi bar? I mean, like, is it going to be that type of stuff? The school has the money, and now we know that food is a, you know, basically non-budget expense, you know, unlimited budget, excuse me.
They'll just go crazy. Possibly on hibachi grill. I could see there being some kind of night maybe where they do it, but the thing that is fascinating to me with the unlimited food is it's coming at a time when player nutrition has become important.
Yeah.
Where at the University of Tennessee, and this I only know it happens at Tennessee. I am almost positive it happens at most college athletes, particularly in football. They all have very, very specific diets to the point where the team nutritionist has a different little workout, post-workout shake for all 100 players on the team, and they all have their numbers on them, and it's all like, because you're an offensive lineman, they're giving you this. You get these chemicals that are supposed to build you up. And that was one thing that Chip Kelly did when he went to the Philadelphia Eagles, was he installed this like new, all these different nutrition stations. And so while it's fun to talk about hibachi stations, I think of the all-you-can-eat, particularly now, as a way that there are no limits to the ways that a school can manufacture. I mean, for lack of a better term, manufacture these perfect athletic specimens.
Yeah, which is all they're trying to do. It's amazing how much
the science and technology
now,
of it.
Obviously, again, not to be naive, but also not to accuse, you know, we all looked kind of silly when we said, man, it's amazing these baseball players are just, you know, getting better and better and better. Yeah. I do think we are better at fine-tuning the body with actual health methods. We would probably be naive to think that some people aren't using ulterior motives, not looking at any specific school. But the steroid, the other stuff aside, it is amazing how much we can engineer eating regimen. It's amazing how much you hear professional players talk about that being a difference in their game. Not like, oh, when I finally decided to watch film, when I finally decided to eat right,
right,
you know, was the year that I went from this to this. Yeah, I feel like you hear that more
but
and more.
But some of it's not always necessarily healthy, because they want to maybe mold you into a body type that you don't have. I think about our buddy Michael Felder told me one semester he was not allowed to run because they wanted him to like put on weight in a different way than his body could. So he was just like crushing carbs, like 5 or 6 carb loaded meals a day, not allowed to run, and just sort of different things like that. Really fascinating stuff.
Nice. All right, I'm going to go from nutrition and body science to a guy who came in obviously in an era before that was big, because he's sort of the champion of not working out. I don't know if he has if it's officially a quote, but he's sort of famous for playing basketball is his workout, and that's Paul Pierce. And I bring him up, even though we're a college basketball podcast, I want to track this backwards a little bit. Paul Pierce, still playing well in the NBA, now clearly looks like one of those guys who can press the gas pedal halfway down during the regular season and then press it to the floor when he needs to in the playoffs. But he's one guy, I feel like more and more the guys are drawing sides, whether it's commentators, former players, whoever, and saying, what is the best training for the NBA? What's the best way to become a great NBA player? Now, there's multiple sides to the draft decision, and one of those is obviously business. So I think you and I oftentimes agree that, you know, I'm not going to tell somebody for their personal situation what the best business decision is. We can look at what the economic differences are based on where you go and when you go.
It's like, yeah, you've got a kid, you've got a family.
Right. I'm not going to tell you what your smartest business decision is, right?
You go.
But if we're looking solely at, you know, Jabari Parker and others, you know, refer to their goal of being an NBA player and being the best player they can be. I think this is a fascinating debate, and most of it is anecdotal, as we point to this player or that player. Well, LeBron clearly was ready, or LeBron probably was best served by going straight to the NBA and learning that game. But then there are guys like Paul Pierce and Tim Duncan who are still in the NBA after, you know, maybe some would say wasting some of their miles or money years or whatever in college. I want to say Paul Pierce was 3, maybe 4, I'm not sure, and I know Tim Duncan was 4. So my question is this, and it's a vague one, I guess. Is it really possible to quantify the training or whatever that college basketball versus NBA basketball gets you? Because here's before I leave you open with the question, here's the example that I'll sort of put it. Let's say you and I are both top 10 recruits in the same class. Okay, you and I both have great freshman year, and we both are projected to be top 10 picks. You go after your freshman year to the NBA, all right? Chip Patterson gets drafted 2nd overall. He jumps straight to the NBA, even though he could have come back to a good team.
Man, they're paying a lot for hustle players right now.
Right. So I am willing to concede that, you know, while you play those next two years in the NBA and I play my next 2 years, we're the same rated, I come back, I go to the Final Four my sophomore year, we lose. My junior year, I lead a Final Four squad with maybe some freshmen who are also good players, and we win the national championship, and then I go. Now, I'm willing to concede that you and I, who are both the same age, you went 1 year of college, and now I've done 2 years of pro, and I did 3 years of college. Sure, you are going to be the better pro player probably next year and maybe even for the next 2 years, because I've still got to now make that adjustment to what is a different game. What I'm not sure is people are looking big picture enough and saying, what exactly was learned in those 2 years? It may not have been a straight jump shot. It may not have been, you know, a specific skill, or especially an NBA skill. Again, shooting may be something I got to work on. But did I learn how to work with teammates? You know, did I get a chance to be a quote unquote superstar? Did Tim Duncan playing in ACC tournaments as a junior senior and being a leader, then when he goes and plays under David Robinson, he gets to transition. But then when David Robinson's gone, now it's Tim Duncan's team. Well, Tim Duncan has been in a situation where it was his team before, even if he's not the loud talkative leader, you know? same with Paul Pierce. You know, he's been a guy who is a leader of a team and a guy who's expected to take the last shot. Even if that's not what he's doing his first year in the NBA, now we see him 15 years later. Are the things that he does now maybe some things that he learned in college and would have missed out on had he gone, you know, pro first year like some other guys? It's a long-winded talk and some questions.
I think that the key is that it's anecdotal to the point where it's so tough to know, even as a player who's trying to make his own decision, whether or not I'm going to be on the type of teams with the type of coaches that are going to help me develop that.
Right.
And there is absolutely something to an experience that Kemba Walker had at UConn, sticking around, being a point guard for that Big East title run and eventual national championship run. Something in that made him ready to come and take over the Charlotte Bobcats as a team leader in only his second or third year and lead them into the playoffs. I mean, that team runs through Kemba and Al Jefferson. I think it probably, and again, this just comes back to the player demand, probably helps guards more than it helps big men, just because if you're big and you know your size, if you're Joel Embiid, like Joel Embiid is going to be 10 years before that guy gets that like that extra edge, that veteran's edge that you're talking about. But a guard who sticks around for a while, I think that particularly in today's game, with the way that so much of the NBA does play off, like pick and roll and the ability to, you know, are you a guy that creates your own shot or are you a guy that knocks it down?
Yeah.
I think that it can benefit guards more than big men. It's mostly anecdotal depending on what kind of team you're on. But there's definitely something to that.
Yeah. And you know, I guess maybe there are guys like Carmelo Anthony who got to be what was the leader on a team, you know, as a freshman. So you could say he did get some of that experience. You know?
But like a Jabari Parker, for example, how many times did what I like to, if I say the word superstar ball, he was playing superstar ball,
right?
Which can be good superstar ball or bad superstar ball.
And so, yeah, and sometimes you need superstar ball.
And I think
Carmelo's a good example. Carmelo, good versus bad sometimes.
That's what I'm thinking. Like Carmelo played superstar ball in college, took that team, won a national championship. He got used to, got comfortable with playing superstar ball. In Duke's first round game against Mercer, Jabari Parker tried to play superstar ball, and it was one of the reasons why Duke lost.
Yeah. Got to look at who it's also one of the things where obviously a guy makes a choice, and we can never go back and say, well, what would it have looked like if he had done the opposite?
Right.
We can never say that. And so it's all projecting, which is what a lot of people do. But, you know, Kevin Durant is a guy, for example. Now, no one would argue, well, that guy should have stayed in school because it probably would have been a bad business decision, and nobody would look at his development now and say, oh, well, he could have been better if he had stayed at Texas. But then you also look, well, he's struggling with the dynamic now where there's another good player on his team, but he should have the ball. You know, is that something where maybe if he had played as a sophomore, as a junior at Texas, that he would have had a smaller scale experience at age 20 or 21 of handling a chemistry dynamic, of doing something, you know, and of knowing how to do it, or getting advice from Rick Barnes, who may be different from a coach that'll have in the pros, you know, and learn something of team dynamics, of how to take a guy that you don't like, but that you need to do certain things on your team and gel with that guy. You know, I just,
I've got you. It definitely makes sense.
I don't know enough. And like I said, because it's all going to be stacked on anecdotal or looking backwards or imagining, you know, if the path had been different type of evidence, which there is no real tangible. But I think
our point is that you don't automatic. We're in a point of rooting for players, and you and I often root for players, but we don't want to root for players to the point of saying like, oh no, any decision to come back is going to mean it's going to be awful.
Right. And I guess maybe I do this too much. And
you know, Poitras is coming back.
Yeah, maybe. And I was going to talk about what, you know, can the coaches even try to suggest that? Cal has basically said, I don't even try and suggest that it'd be a good idea to come back because then people will rake me over the coals for for the wrong reason. So I don't even do it. But I guess maybe it goes back to this sort of the general how much of basketball is forming the best team, but how much. Yeah, the best team is usually going to be the one with the best players, but there is something to the way those players interact with each other. So, you know, if the NBA, if golf or tennis were a popular college sport and sort of you had that same sort of decision-making, it'd be a lot easier, I think, for an individual to say, well, yeah, you need to move on to the next one, to ply your trade. The next level, imply your trade as soon as you can, especially on the money-making level. I just think when there are dynamics, nobody can deny. I mean, we talk every year about Durant and Westbrook and that dynamic. And I just don't know if that's one of those things that maybe if you get experience working those things out before you're a professional, or you know, that it can be something that can help you down the road. Again, you can't say definitely we'll see it worked for that guy, because then you could always say, well, we don't know what would have happened for him. But I just, I don't know. I sort of see it a little bit that way. And I guess Paul Pierce going off in his first playoff game.
He was quiet all game, and then it was just like Paul Pierce is like the – well, Paul Pierce's game is YMCA.
Well, yeah, and that game that he's playing is a very much – he's learned how to play. He's playing an NBA game. I get that. But I just mean more of the, you know, how does he take a team over from Joe Johnson, who should be getting the shot? You know, sort of just general basketball sense and having different coaches, learning from different people, and learning from people who – learning when you aren't thinking about it as your career or your next job move, you know, when you're just thinking of just like you do in college, you know, where you get a chance to try something a little bit different, try something, you know, different.
You know what? Here's
without the pressure of it being your
job.
Here's
a great example. I think that every player that goes to Team USA camp and at least gets far enough to make it beyond the 27-man roster, and that is a staff that is littered with good, great college coach. Coach K, Boeheim, you know, Cal's involved with the Dominican team. I think that when you see NBA players get better, and I think that players like Kevin Durant, Derrick Rose got so much better after the 2010 World Championships. I think LeBron probably made his leap in the 2008 Olympics.
After that college coaching.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. You know, the point being that, there's absolutely some different learning stuff that goes on at that college level. And it's something that, again, if you or I are both there and our own business decision or whatever, if all that's in a vacuum, it's something you absolutely consider.
All right, question, and this is more just for fun. I'm not asking you who should be the number one pick. I'm not asking you who's better, anything like that. Of the guys, well, I mean, you can throw in juniors or seniors too. Of the guys who are eligible for the draft who we saw play in college this year, is there a guy that you would most like to see on your favorite NBA team? Again, not saying that he's the best, just like I like this guy a lot. Or, you know, is it? I'll give you mine, and it partly is topical. But again, I'm not saying that he's better than Joel Embiid or Jabari Parker, but like, I would want Julius Randle on my team. The same way I kind of wanted DeMarcus Cousins. Now, what I wanted with DeMarcus Cousins, I would want to be the NBA team. Now, he's stayed with the Kings, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to be DeMarcus Cousins' second NBA team. I thought he was a little young, and to his credit, he seemed to have worked some of the immaturity and now is already seemed to be on a pretty good track.
Well, now it's just less frequent. He's like the thunderstorms. Like, monsoons are gone, but they'll have a thunderstorm.
I wanted to be the Grizzlies that got Zach Randolph. I wanted to be that for DeMarcus Cousins. Yeah. Now I want Julius Randle.
It's hard to argue.
Again,
I'm
not saying he's better than Jabari Parker or Embiid. I do like Parker has a look about him of like pretty polished, and he has a look about him of a guy who won't stop improving. You know, he seems to work better, but Randle just, you know,
I'm terrified of Embiid. Since this is a document, I will say that there's just something there where. You know, whether it's the injury concerns or the wear and tair. I mean, I just think that people's bodies are already just stressed and tested to certain points. And I don't want to say Greg Oden, but you know, like if you're starting to see issues pop up, then certainly if I'm at three, you know, and Julius Randle and Joel Embiid are there, I'm taking Randle.
I just think Julius Randle, I feel like he's a mix between two players that I like a lot in the post, Taj Gibson and the other guy we just said for the Grizzlies, Zach Randolph.
Yes,
he's halfway between.
He's bigger than Zach.
He's bigger, but not quite as thick. He doesn't play quite as like a dirty dog post guy, kind of like Zach did some. But
you and I were saying the other day we were talking about Randle, and I was pointing out, you know, he had one move at the beginning.
And
the exciting thing about Randle is that he developed other moves.
Yeah.
And there were times, like in the Wichita State game, where I was like, good God, this guy is not going to be stopped at all.
Yeah.
I would rock with you on that one. I don't love, you know, I don't love Wiggins. When Wiggins is at his top, then it's like, wow, this guy is.
Yeah,
like,
he'll have some highlights, but no, he'd be in one of like, again, I'm not even saying he's worse than Julius Randle, but I wouldn't be just fired up about Wiggins right now.
I would
now.
Not be fired up he's, about Aaron Gordon.
He just doesn't fire me up. Again, whereas Julius Randle, my God, I'd pay to go see that guy play and maybe like, you know, put on a dunk contest in the warm-ups.
Are you going to hate on our foreign players that are going to end up in the first round?
I can't hate them. I don't know who they are.
We've got Dante Exum is a guy who is fallen in a lot of top tens. He's from Australia.
Yeah, but he played in college, right?
Yes.
I thought you were talking about straight international, like coming from international teams.
No.
Okay. How far? Yeah, we got a ways to go for the NBA draft. That we went to the end of the playoffs. Let's wrap it up for this edition of the Walk-Ons. Maybe we'll see if the NCAA makes any changes. We'll see if they adopt Konki in the schools
or any hibachi grill
or hibachi grill or sushi bars, and we'll make some more relevant NCAA legislation changes for next week so that they can adopt those. For Chip, I'm Hayes. This is the Walk-On.
Once again, it's time to buy more soul. Flavor you will savor in your soul. Wax is distributed and then sold. Dishwasher sends you in your next of kin soul. PA makes his proctor on the console. Scream your heart until you blow your console. Bangle bang until you wear your shoe soul. And you are now dancing to the new soul. Just as a reminder from the last step, negative ones are lost.